Welcome, everybody. My name is Tim Hildebrandt. I'm an associate professor in social policy at LSC, and I'm a member of the governing council of the LSC Fudan Global Public Policy Hub. So it's in those two capacities, I suppose, that I'm here today. And I'm joined by one of my favorite people in the world, my collaborator and very good friend, Riza Hasmuth. Riza is a full professor of political science at the University of Alberta in Canada. And, you know, I could go through his long list of multiple books and dozens of articles, but you can take a look at that yourself, other than to just suggest that, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about your work, Riza, and something that I think those of us at the LSC and in the audience today would really appreciate is how policy relevant it is. You know, the work that you do and the work that we do together indeed is really very much motivated by ongoing issues in the realm of policy. And, you know, it's all theoretically informed, right, and empirically grounded, but I think more importantly, it's relevant to policymakers. And, you know, I think it's within this vein that you and I are having this conversation today about civic participation in China. As the title of the talk suggests, our conversation today is going to be, you know, a bit about the things that are frequently associated with good citizenship. Things like volunteerism and philanthropic giving. And so what I thought might make sense in moving the conversation forward, and I hopefully our participants are on board with this as well, is I'm going to start asking you some questions that in part I know the answer to, or I have an answer to them, but questions that you and I have been thinking about for at least the last 5 years, and really give us an opportunity to talk a bit more in detail about this major research project that we've been working on for a long time, and, you know, give our participants an insight into both the findings that we've already gleaned and published in some articles, but also some of the work that you and I in particular are working on at this moment. So I hope everybody is going to find this as interesting and useful as, frankly, I know you and I will, because in a way, you're all kind of getting a firsthand look at conversations that Riza and I are having all the time, literally conversations that you and I have been having in the last week. And so that's my plan. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds lovely. And thank you for that warm introduction. And thank you for the LSC Fudan Global Public Policy Hub for organizing this conversation. This is a really interesting project that Tim and our colleagues have engaged with for the last few years. And we're really pleased to be able to share some of our insights and some of the future things we're going to be doing. Some of the things we're talking, we're still talking it through. So you might find some contradictions perhaps in our conversations, but it's a very exciting project. And I hope to, you know, throughout these conversations we're having today and in the future that we can elucidate some of the findings and especially the policy findings that comes out of our work.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think first things first, before we even delve into the project itself, this really important question, which is, what makes a good citizen?
That is the key question. Anytime you have a good citizen, you're putting a value judgment of what good is. So, you know, we can go back to the classic stuff, like the classic theoretical stuff. And there's like this sort of relationship between civic participation and democratic learning. So think about like Western literatures, you talk about Alex de Tocqueville, talking about volunteerism, talking about citizens need to organize, they need to hold accountability. They need to have this sort of idea that the good citizen is one who participates in society so they can volunteer, they can donate, they can play a role, an active role in their society at large. So, you know, it's so subjective, but generally speaking, have those characteristics. And I know the audience is thinking, okay, that's great. That's lovely. That's a democratic society. How does that work for non-democratic societies or societies that have different trajectories or philosophical trajectories than, say, the Western ones? And there's still that sort of conceptualization, right? There's an active citizen, someone who's actually in the community, someone who's doing work in the community, trying to participate in the community actively. And then there's, shall we say, the not active citizen, the passive citizen. So, you know, if you're going to make a value judgment, I would say maybe the active citizen is someone we think as more good and the passive citizen's one maybe not as good, even though that's debatable. But there is that spectrum. That's the most basic element here. There's a spectrum between active citizens and passive citizens.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you started to allude to this already in your discussion about the connection with democratic principles and values. But, you know, I have long been really curious as to what the relationship might be with all of these characteristics that we associate with good citizenship in non-democracies. You know, I guess it begs the question, all of those characteristics that we've discussed that frequently are associated with a particular context, do they exist? To what extent do they exist in authoritarian states like China? And what's the outcome?
So that's a great question. And in fact, it's a question we try to answer, you know, both Tim, myself, and some of our colleagues. You know, we have a paper out in the Journal of Contemporary China looking at citizenship and citizenship education. And what we find in that paper, in that study that uses the Chinese civic participation surveys, is that contemporary citizenship education in China has contradictory messages. On the one hand, it's really asking citizens to follow the party's efforts, not to participate really in determining what these efforts will be. So there's like that sort of passive citizen. On the other hand, through schooling, through education, it teaches students that they need to become technologically advanced, critical, innovative, globally competitive citizens. And by doing so, you're going to serve China well. So you're going to have, in the Chinese context, you're really trying to construct a balance between the sort of passive and the active citizen. So it's again, those attributes still exist in non-democracies, this active and passive sort of conceptualization. So a good citizen in China can be understood along this sort of continuum that extends from a complete passive obedience to more active, but perhaps constrained participation. Again, this is all like high level theoretical, but then we test it with the surveys. We actually ask people, what does it mean to be a good citizen? And we gave them ranking responses. So some of the responses we asked them to rank is a good citizen someone who supports the Communist Party? Is it business and entrepreneurship? Is it education and expertise? Is it volunteer service and charity? Is it service in government? Is it abiding by laws and regulations? Mm-hmm. And what we found was that generally speaking, a good citizen is one who has good education and expertise and someone who abides by laws and regulations. So it's a very duty-bound conceptualization of a good citizen.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I want to delve more deeply into maybe who defines what good is. Mm. I keep going back to these big existential questions, but, you know, part of this, you know, I want us to kind of go back a little bit to try to better understand why we know that the Chinese government does care about this, right? So what is, you know, and I'm hoping you could reflect a little bit on what motivated us as scholars to pursue this line of research. What was there a moment in particular in your mind? I know there was for me, but a moment in your mind that made you realize, oh, this is absolutely a priority for the Chinese government and it's worth studying.
So there's a few moments. Some are superficial, some are much more academically rooted. So let me say some of the superficial stuff first, because I think it's worthwhile saying things that are stereotypical and it's out there. First is, you know, there's this common perception among many circles, although that perception might be waning, is that this is all about state control. If the state can understand what citizens think is good and bad, it's able to control the citizens. I think that's a very stereotypical sort of conceptualization. I think it's not rooted in full reality. And the reason why I suggest that is that because I also do a lot of work with policymakers. I look at the psychology of policymakers in China. I do psychometric testing of them. I've worked with the Chinese government for about almost two decades. And I think really at the end of the day, why it's worthwhile understanding what a good citizen is because it gives you greater predictability. It gives you greater insight into what the citizenry wants at present day and in the future. So it gives the state insight into the expectations of the citizenry.
Yeah.
And so there's this sort of balancing act because, you know, there's a highly much more educated population in China than ever beforehand. And with that, you know, general theories, you know, if you look at modernization theories, whether or not you hold them with a great assault or not, but those kinds of theories suggest with greater education, values might shift. And so effectively, what we're suggesting here is that, hey, if the socioeconomic dimensions of the Chinese society is shifting, their expectations of citizenship might shift. And if the state's not aware of that, that could be very problematic. It can actually reduce regime resiliency. So I think in a much more academic, much more refined way, it's important for us and it's important for the Chinese government to care about good citizens and perhaps conversely bad citizens, because it allows you to understand what the expectations of the citizenry is. Yeah. And you can see that they're doing this through, you know, the social credit system, which in many respects is rewarding what the state's perceiving as a good citizen or not. So there's characteristics of what's good and what's bad. And you know what? All societies do this. All states have a conceptualization of what a good citizen is. And we have a conceptualization of what a bad citizen is. Mm-hmm. And so it's not only within mainland China we say that.
Yeah, I really like that, and it reminds me that that incentivizing, and as you mentioned with the social credit system, which, you know, was one of those policy developments that motivated our study in the first place. This idea that the state was beginning to piecemeal, mind you, in different locales, incentivizing, you know, what we think of as good citizenry behavior, right? Things like, you know, volunteering, giving philanthropically, and just, you know, more generally behaving well and disincentivizing bad behavior. That there is something there, you know, you could, on the one hand, look at it, this is a means of control. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you can think about it more along the lines of, you know, the work of James Scott and the work of Benedict Anderson, that it's about states creating societies in ways that makes them more easily understood. And, you know, this gets to what you and I have also written about and researched in the context of non-governmental organizations. It's not necessarily about getting rid of them, right, or controlling them. It's about molding them in an image that the state, you know, is more likely to be able to trust.
I that love they, that term, trust. Yeah.
Yeah, that there. So it's more visible, but also I think it's this homogenization of the citizenry. You know, if you are going to homogenize the citizenry, and you should if you're a state, because that makes them, you know, I talk about this a lot in my own research, like, you know, states don't want citizenries that are complicated because they're very easy to or very difficult to govern. Right. This is when you look at the census, you know, if you want to read a good piece on this, I think it's chapter 10 in Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities, amazing, right? But in his work, you know, he talks about the census is created as a means for the state to essentially get people to move into categories that it wants them to be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I really, you know, I hadn't thought about this so much, Risa, that the Chinese government and all governments in trying to advocate and promote, however they choose to do it, good citizenry behavior, it's not just that volunteering and philanthropy help society. And sometimes they do, but also sometimes they don't. Sometimes, and you know, we've looked at this as well, sometimes the work of volunteers is sort of meaningless, right? I hate to put it, but it's, you know, it's like, you know, they might go out and, you know, spend a little bit of time cleaning up a highway, and they do it once a year. It's a drop in the bucket. Is that having a demonstrably good effect on, you know, the environment? Maybe not, probably not. But what it is doing is teaching, and this gets to the work that we've done on democratic learning, teaching people about the way that they should behave, and in hopes that, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but in hopes that this huge population that China has is increasingly behaving in a similar way. Does that ring?
It does hold a lot of semblance to the work that I do. It was also the sort of lectures that I give on managing government in Western jurisdictions, in fact. That is, if you're a government, you want two things. You want predictability, and you want to be able to trust the actors you're dealing with. And that's like public policy 101. You want to have predictability as much as possible. And with that predictability generates trust. I'm more likely to work with the citizenry. I'm more likely to work with an organization if I can see the predictability in that. That's why the longer an organization exists, there's greater predictability. More likely a government is going to interact with that organization. So when we do see the good citizen, or whatever sort of conceptualization of the good citizen that we have, once it's consistent, once they're learned in a way that's consistent to what the state can recognize, it creates that predictability. The converse can create chaos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think when we are looking at good and bad citizens, ultimately we are trying to look at what gives you predictable outcomes of how the citizenry is going to behave in the present day and in the future. And I think that's why it's worthwhile, you know, trying to dig into the Chinese state to see how are citizens actually behaving. And so you talked about volunteerism. I think that's really interesting because we do have a lot of information about, you know, why do citizens volunteer? So we're actually, I mean, shouldn't be surprising to those in the conversation today. You know, younger individuals are more likely to report being open to volunteering. The average volunteer is going to dedicate about 3 to 5 hours per month. And the general reasons for volunteering is because they want to spend time with friends and co-workers or co-volunteers or co-workers. So it's more of that social aspect of volunteering. And what's interesting about that if you put this survey in most jurisdictions globally, you're going to have very similar results. It's usually a younger cohort. They're doing it because of that sort of social interactions. But it gets deeper than that. And it goes to what you were just suggesting there, Tim, is that this idea that by volunteering, you're learning what it means to participate within your community. So that's where we need to, and especially in the Chinese case, we need to disaggregate between citizen-led volunteerism and state-led volunteerism. For the longest time, there's been state-led volunteerism. What we've seen in the last decade and a bit is a rise in citizen-led volunteerism, even more so. So there's greater space for citizens to actually, you know, lead their initiatives more so than the state doing so.
Risa, to interject, could you explain a little bit more about the difference between state-led and citizen-led? And in particular, what I'm hoping that you can reflect on a little bit is, you know, this is a comment embedded within the question, by the way, but, you know, to what extent is citizen-led volunteerism, is there space for citizen-led volunteerism essentially in the context of China, where there are all of these state incentives that are kind of meddling with the motivations?
Right. So great question and an interesting comment. Okay, so we got to put our academic hat on and then take our academic hat off afterwards. Put our academic hat on, we're going to say there's two ideas. There's a citizen-led sort of volunteer and a state-led volunteer. If we take our hats off, we're going to say, well, they interact with each other. It's really hard to disaggregate them because there's interactions. What a state-led volunteer, simply put, is you might have, a state organization, a GONGO, a government-organized NGO. You might have the China Youth League, for example. You might have CANGO, the organization of NGOs. They might be calling for volunteers. They might be, you know, leading the volunteer action. They might be leading the activities of the volunteer. They might be skewing the volunteers to particular issue areas and so forth. So it's effectively state-directed, state-led, and state-organized, effectively. Mm. So when we say state-led volunteerism, that's what we're suggesting. Citizen-led volunteerism, slightly different. It's again, citizens, usually local, super local. They see there's an issue in their local community. They see perhaps the state's not responding to it as much as they want them to do. And so they organized, with among their friends and their social groups and their family members. And they organized to try and fix the situation or to ameliorate the situation. So I don't know, it could be like, let's recycle a bit more in our community. Let's clean up pollution a little bit in our community. Let's try to service the needs of some impoverished migrant workers, perhaps. You can find it. And the difference between the state-led is that the citizen-led is it's organized to the citizens. There's not necessarily a very loose objective to reduce whatever issue or to ameliorate or address the issue that they see. So it's a very different understanding. Now, of course, they interact. Sure. The state-led and the citizen-led. So sometimes it's difficult to actually disaggregate that. Mm-hmm. And the average person probably doesn't see the difference. They might see, it's just volunteerism.
Yeah, it's interesting. Of course, in the Chinese context and a lot of post-communist conflicts, there is a conflict amongst the citizenry about even volunteering, right? There is, to some extent, I think, a lingering legacy in post-communist societies that attached all voluntaristic activity to state-led volunteerism, which is really being voluntold, not volunteering, right? The state really, and to be fair, and you and I have chatted about this quite a bit before, there are plenty of places that are not post-communist or in fact liberal democracies where there is quite a bit of voluntolding to do as well. If you are working in a multinational corporation and you are, you get an email from your boss that says, hey, the entire team is going out to, clean up a highway. Are you going to come? I mean, if you want to ingratiate yourself with your boss, you're going to say, yeah, well, is that being, is that volunteering? I don't know. But the point that I'm getting at more in sort of these political contexts is that you could imagine people in, again, post-communist context and to some extent China would be, suspect to the whole idea of volunteering because it's been state-led. So I'm wondering if you can reflect a little bit on to what extent we see any sort of kind of bad lingering aftertaste from the past of when people would be voluntold to do things in China, especially, the older generation going back to the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward to what's happening today with the social credit system.
So that's the key bit there when looking at the demographics. Most people are volunteering, particularly citizen-led volunteers, are very young. They have not been socialized in a way that they might be voluntold, to use your language. They have not been socialized in that fashion. They don't have social cues from their parents or from the elders that they associate with to say, hey, this might be a suspect, perhaps. So what we do see, the profile of the volunteer, person who does citizen-led volunteer, they slightly are more educated, slightly have a slightly higher income, and they're much younger as well. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, we're seeing that with donations as well, a very similar reality that, again, it's the younger people who are donating. Which is interesting because that varies then in Western jurisdictions where you figure it's the older generation is doing it because they tend to have higher incomes. They want to actually, you know, donate because they have higher incomes. Whereas what we're seeing in the, at least in our surveys, is that it's a younger generation doing that. Why that's important, it holds credence to your argument that, well, maybe the older generation might have different kinds of expectations of how they should donate or how they should volunteer. If they're told to, then perhaps they might. But what we're seeing with the younger ones, it's a very different reality. So we have these sub-generations. Mm-hmm. Another sort of thing we can talk about when you're looking at volunteerism in this respect is, are we looking at volunteerism in terms of altruistic volunteerism or self-interested volunteerism? And that's another way to think of good and bad, some people have argued, because, you know, we like to think in our society, we shouldn't benefit. The ideal scenario, if you look, go to the philosophers and so forth, it's like, if you're volunteering, if you're giving to a community, you shouldn't benefit from it. That's a true altruistic, quote, good volunteer. Yeah. Versus if there's self-interestedness there, it might be the converse, the bad citizen, perhaps. That is something that we've had conversations about, and it's a very touchy and it's a very, you know, malleable sort of idea that we are discussing, because ultimately, I think we should criticize that. We should critique that. Mm-hmm. Why can't you have both altruistic and self-interestedness? Can you actually analytically divide self-interestedness and altruism? Mm-hmm. I'll give you a great example of that. Let's just say both of us are volunteering. Maybe we were told by LSE or Alberta to volunteer, and we do so, but maybe we feel great doing so. Maybe, you know, sort of out of self-interestedness, we do so because it's our duty, our institutions tells us to do that. But maybe we actually believe in the cause. Maybe we feel as though we're giving back to the society. We're donating our time, and it makes us feel good. There's both altruism and self-interestedness by the virtue of feeling good. So there's that sort of interplay, so to speak, that it's really difficult to analytically dissect.
Yeah, I think that's right. I just want to quickly pause and invite invite our participants to put questions in the chat box that you have and kind of join the conversation. I want to go back to this issue, as you probably would expect, this issue of altruism, because I know that, you know, my students are especially interested in the role of altruism in all of these activities, perhaps in part because of this assumption that if one is altruistic, you will then be more likely to engage in this activity. Maybe that's why people care about it. But of course, what you're already suggesting, and as our survey has made quite clear, that the reasons that people volunteer doesn't really have much to do with what we might typically think of as altruism, right? That the main reasons are, as you said, spending time with friends and co-volunteers, but also pleasing your supervisor, teacher, or boss. I mean, is that altruistic? Why do you want to please them? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you could say that that is altruistic, that you want people to be pleased. But generally speaking, this idea of doing something to please people is because we expect them being pleased will somehow reflect better on us. And then, you know, if you look at what the third in our ranked findings was, that it's enjoyable and emotional fulfilling. I mean, this is what psychologists have identified in the last couple decades. This is that warm glow, that good feeling that people get. And, you know, now we might be getting into a bit of a semantics debate. Is the warm glow, mind you, it is third down on our list, so it's not the number one reason, but is the warm glow simply a manifestation of altruism, or is the warm glow self-interest?
So let me start off by saying, if we were to reduce these arguments to the most basic level, I suspect we're going to get to a point where there's no such thing as pure altruism. I suspect, so I would like to immediately stress that, because if we're talking about pure altruism, that by virtue of my, you know, that sort of warm glow, that's simply the only motivation that I have to volunteer or to donate, I don't think that fully exists. I think there's always ways in which we can construct that there might be some sense of self-interestedness by virtue of the individual trying to achieve pure altruism, it's going to be a self-interestedness element to it. I know that might sound philosophical here, but ultimately what I'm suggesting to you here is that there's no such thing as pure altruism. What I would suggest is that you can have instrumental reasons to actually, you know, volunteer or to donate, or you can have a greater sort of intrinsic sense of empathy towards self-interestedness, an intrinsic self of altruism, so to speak. And so in the literature, they talk about, for example, charitable donations, which are given for tax purposes, which is given for personal gain. And here we say that that sort of donation is for instrumental reasons. This is contrast to the sort of intrinsic sense of altruism. It's not necessarily pure altruism. It's a sort of empathy towards others, perhaps. And this is where, you know, we can say that people might donate or volunteer on that virtue there. So it's really, I think, a mistake to say that the good or bad citizen is going to be pure altruistic or not. Another thing that we can talk about is duty. In duty-based societies, they're more likely to give, they're more likely to volunteer than non-duty-based societies. And the classic sort of economic game you can play, you can ask someone. So I say to Tim, Tim, I'm giving you $100, but the only caveat is you need to give a stranger X amount of that $100. That stranger is never going to know that you had $100. That stranger is never going to see you again. How much would you give? And that's a great example in which, and so in societies where they say, I'll give $50, $80, $90, that's usually a duty-based society. In societies where they say, I give one or zero, well, 25 cents, you have to give something. It's a non-duty-based society. And in China, you find when we do these experiments, we actually find that it's usually 25 cents or a dollar. It's a non-duty-based society, which is interesting. In other Western jurisdictions, we find that as well. The reason why I make this analogy is, well, when you're volunteering and when you're donating, we have to understand the context of society to understand altruism. Is it altruistic in a non-duty-based society? Might be very different than altruistic in a duty-based society. That all plays has an influence. Issue at hand is it's really difficult to measure. So we can theoretically talk about it, but measuring it, and this is something we've had conversations about. How do we measure this? Like we can have a theoretical construction of it, measuring it is very difficult. The last attribute I want to mention is, so in another set of surveys, I actually try to measure people's ideological construction. It's really hard to do that in China. It's actually hard to do that in any society. What we found in the Chinese case is that there's no fixed ideological construction. And so if that means people are going to shift their ideologies. And what I mean by ideology, I don't mean political ideology. I mean, would they give, would they donate, would they do well unto others and so forth. It shifts over time. And that's actually consistent with most societies. So if you're having this shifting going on in terms of ideological construction, if you don't understand if altruism cannot be pure in its purest sense, what a good and bad citizen is from a theoretical standpoint is suspect. But from a policy standpoint, as we've talked about, it is important that there is a sort of idea of what a good and bad citizen is. Every society is going to set that. Because again, as we talked about, we want to have that predictability. The social credit system might provide that. Understanding that there's an educated population, more so in China, they might have different expectations of how the citizen's role might be with the state and vice versa. So the state has to be acutely aware of that. And we're seeing that in terms of the policy outcomes or the policy prescriptions or work. That's something that we're seeing. We're arguing that. We're arguing that, for example, citizen-led volunteerism has largely increased in popularity due to a perception that state-led volunteerism is overly formalistic. So to combat this perception, it's actually worthwhile for the state to partner with civil society organizations to rethink the volunteering experience. If citizens are seeing the state-led experience is very formalistic and it's not as meaningful as, say, the citizen one, well, if you're in the state, one reaction is to actually partner with civil society organizations. And in order to increase state-led volunteerism and mitigate perceived risk from citizen-led volunteerism, the state can actually empower like the China Youth League, which for the last decade has had its autonomy and funding reduced. So these are some of the main policy recommendations we can actually derive from some of the work we're doing. So it's not only theoretical, there's some major practical ones as well.
Riza, I mean, you raise a really good point about how you know, ideologies, motivations, maybe even to the extent to which a society is duty bound versus non-duty bound, that this changes over time. And, you know, in a way, we, in our research, anticipate this because the survey that you and I keep referring to is, of course, a longitudinal study, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was a year ago that we launched the third wave of the survey, and we'll be launching the fourth wave of the survey in a year. So it's every 2 years. Could you reflect a little bit on, you know, to what extent have we been seeing these shifts over time? And if not, you know, is that evidence that maybe China doesn't have much movement in this? Or is the time frame too short, or what's happening?
So there's a few things we can see over the last. So we have a 2018, 2020, 2022, and we're going to do a 2024 wave of their surveys. There's a few things that we've seen in which there is some shifts over the time. One has to deal with COVID and the impact of COVID, for example. So, you know, what we see here is that citizens are generally satisfied with the state's management of national disasters and emergencies, but they're increasingly concluding that the state alone cannot manage them. Mm-hmm. We saw that in the 2018 survey. We start seeing that increase in the 2020 survey. And we're seeing that in the 2022 survey even more so. Chinese citizens are increasingly seeing a complementary role for civil society organizations in times of crisis. That's the sort of big headline. We're also seeing that volunteers over the years who have meaningfully interacted with CSOs, civil society organizations, they're more skeptical than non-volunteers about CSO's ability to fulfill a crisis management function. So it really suggests that the political legitimacy of the party is not challenged by allowing CSOs a greater role in crisis management. So I think that's the main key attribute that we've seen over the three survey waves is the state, how citizens perceive the state's management of national disasters and emergencies. There's other things as well, of course, in terms of volunteerism. We've definitely seen that the role and function of citizen-led volunteers is very different than a democratic one. When citizens in China volunteer, they learn to differentiate channels most appropriate for addressing specific social problems. But contra Western jurisdictions, Chinese volunteers generally do not try to directly hold their governments accountable for poor performance. So that's really key, is that there isn't that sort of accountability that we see in other jurisdictions when citizens volunteer more. Mm. And the last thing I would suggest is that looking at the more years of citizenship education a Chinese citizen is exposed to, the less likely they're influenced by state-led conceptions of citizenship, which is characterized by passive obedience. So those are the three main things we've seen consistent throughout our waves of the survey.
Riza, Yinquan Li asked the question, and I think this is a good time to pose it, does a state-led incentive in particular, like the social credit system, lead volunteers to be more self-interested as they have more self-interest on the line, right? I mean, for those students who are joining us who aren't familiar with the social credit system and how it was designed to work in terms of incentivizing, right? It would be, I think, the classic example that we like to give is, you know, if you volunteer, you get points, and those points can allow you to do things like travel first class and high speed rail, right? It's not a disincentive to the point where it is making it impossible for you to travel, but you know, it's a little bonus, right? So is there any indication that those state-led incentive structures lead them to be more self-interested? And you know, is there any sense that there are going to be negative effects in having this incentive structure that really kind of forces their hand?
That's a great question. Interestingly enough, what we find is that state-led sort of volunteers and citizen-led volunteers, especially when they're young, when they are volunteering, they're signaling to the state that they can be emerging sort of individuals who can be leaders within the local community. So in that respect, and in fact, this is what we found in our democratization paper this year. The title, I guess if you're interested, is called Volunteerism and Democratic Learning in an Authoritarian State in the 2022 Democratization Journal. Our results actually suggest that volunteers are participating as a means to send signals to the state that they're emerging local community leaders. So it is out of self-interest. Now, at the heart of the question is, do we see that self-interestedness more so in state-led versus citizen-led? It's hard to disaggregate because the main issue we have is, how do we define self-interestedness?
That's right.
And so that's the main issue we have. What I would suggest to you is that if we're looking at the reasons why they're volunteering and reasons why they are, the outcomes of their volunteering, it's more skewed towards self-interestedness. So it's not necessarily state-led versus citizen-led leads to greater self-interestedness. It's both equally have major elements of that. Where the difficult part is the altruistic part. How do we suggest that one is more altruistic than the other? Now, at the surface level, you would say, well, state-led is less altruistic. Mm-hmm. But if you're a citizen-led volunteer, well, maybe it's not altruism. I'll give you a great example. In the early days when we did a lot of work on NGOs, why do individuals start NGOs? Why do they start social organizations? It's always that founder. And you ask the founder, why are you doing it? Right. And he said, oh, it's because I want to help my society. I want to help, you know, I see an issue that I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. Now, is that altruistic or is that out of self-interestedness? Yeah. Now, we would say there's altruism there. But it's self-interestedness sort of outcomes, because that person's profile increases. They get more better standing within the community, better networks, and so forth. So it's really difficult to disaggregate that. That's a great question, but unfortunately, we can't disaggregate it to a satisfactory manner.
Yeah, it's a great question and a really good answer, though, as best as we can give. You're right. You know, the line that I used in my book that I'll never get out of my head, I wrote it, but it was a good line, that for, you know, these NGO leaders, these founders, it's not just a cause, it's a career. Mm-hmm. And it's this reminder that, you know, probably the most sustainable volunteeristic and philanthropic giving is the kind of activity that does a bit of both, that meets the needs of these, like, very, dare we say, selfish needs of wanting recognition, of wanting that warm glow, of wanting to feel like you're doing well, and being able to make connections with people in the community that might actually lead to a job. It reminds me a lot of, you know, the conversations that you and I have had about corporate social responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, multinational corporations adopting CSR projects. You know, why do they do it? Well, you know, it's difficult to get into the heads of philanthropic capitalists or these, you know, the CEOs of these organizations and know exactly what their motivation is. I'm not sure if it totally matters. It might always be about profits, especially for profit organizations. But what makes this sustainable is that it probably does a little bit of both, that it makes them feel good and it's good for business, right? Mm-hmm. And it leads me to a question from Wang Yan, who's actually a postdoctoral fellow in the hub. She asks if you could introduce a bit more on the potential for enterprise or commercial related volunteerism in China. She says it seems like the role of enterprise commercial related volunteerism is a key force in democratic systems that promote the formation of civil society in what I was just kind of describing in the case of CSR. Well, in China, to what extent There be, you know, this space? She mentions too, you know, specifically during COVID, companies were initiating voluntaristic activities and providing opportunities for individuals to join it, and probably more frequent than volunteer, contribute financially. Are there signs of that in the Chinese context?
So this actually brings me to my other sort of work. I look at global sustainability standards and looking at ESG principles in Chinese and East Asian firms. So I'm going to marry a couple of these kind of big topics. First thing I want to suggest, and it kind of goes to the heart of that question as well, is the hardest thing one can do if you're looking for charitable giving is actually getting someone to donate once. That first time, it's the hardest thing. If you speak to those who do philanthropy, finding that to convince someone to donate the first time is the hardest thing. Once they donate, they're more likely to donate again. And what our data is showing from the civic participation surveys that we've done is that because citizens have that understanding of donation, because of the ease of it, whether it's through social media, they can do it through Weibo, or they can do it through any sort of WeChat or any along those lines. It's so easy to donate at small amounts, but even at a larger level, it's easier to donate and you're socialized to do so. That tells us in the future, they're more likely to donate again. Because it's the hardest things that first time. Now, if you're a corporate or enterprise level sort of entity, there are two forces in play here. There are macro forces and there are micro forces. The macro forces, I would say, globally, there's a global sustainability standard if you're listed in Shanghai or Shenzhen, if you're looking at the mainland, Hong Kong has it as well, if you want to look at that. There's a greater attunement right now to the E side, so the environmental side, but it's also the S side, the social and the corporate governance side. And as those markets make it both regulatory, provide regulatory kinds of responses to ESG, it's going to require its corporate citizens to actually either donate, volunteer more, to be a better sort of corporate citizen, so to speak. So there's going to be that kind of regulatory push, or what we might say sociologically, there's this coercive pressures, right? So there's that sort of macro space there. Then there's the micro level space, which I kind of elaborated here when I was suggesting that actually citizens and corporate citizens and corporate individuals working in enterprises do want to volunteer more. They want to feel good about their company. It is good business to have a happy citizen, have a happy worker. When I was in the business school and I was teaching organizational behavior, I always told my students, a happy worker is a productive worker and you can pay them less. Well, let's forget the last part there. But a happy worker, as though they're contributing back to society. Volunteer, if people feel as though their enterprise is good, is doing well to the community at large, is socially responsible, you find that they're happier and they're more productive. So it's good business to actually encourage your employees to give back to society, because especially among the younger generation, they do want to do that. They want to actually play a role within the society at large. Now, in the Chinese context, it's slightly a bit trickier because you have the state embedded in many enterprise level, whether it's decision making to at least has an influence in enterprise levels. There's a greater sort of public-private sort of relationship than, say, other jurisdictions. That's a nice way to put it. And so the state can actually play a role in incentivizing enterprises to encourage greater voluntarism and to encourage greater charitable giving as well. And so, you know, you have very slightly different mechanisms in play, but overall, the macro and micro level forces are very similar in China as it is in other jurisdictions. So in a very short answer, I would say, yes, there is a greater space for enterprises to assist and to encourage greater volunteerism among its corporate citizens, among its, down its supply chain even. I think that's the key bit there. If you want to get really, really kind of, you know, technical and sort of minute here. It's those large firms down their supply chain. They're the ones who are encouraging greater sort of ESG and sustainability and volunteerism. That behavior of what it means to be a good citizen within the corporate lens is being transferred down the supply chain. It's slow, but it will happen in the 2020s and into the early 2030s.
Reza, I can't resist the temptation to draw upon in listening to your answer about, you know, both kind of the role of the state and the market in kind of moving this behavior along. I can't resist the temptation, but to draw upon, you know, two terms that have come up in popular literature quite a lot lately, which is the nudge and the friction. Or so it's about creating some sort of nudge to get people to behave a certain way, right? And so, you know, we know how that might work in the corporate context. There can be small little incentives. If you're an employee, that's one thing. That incentive could be the being voluntold, essentially. Hey, this might improve your prospects for promotion. But then the other, you know, if you are simply a consumer, well, maybe behaving in a certain way can result in getting a small, like, selective incentive. So like a discount or something. So those would be the nudge. But then I hear you also talking about reducing friction, right? Sort of, and again, this comes out in popular literature nowadays. If you want to behave in a certain way, you want to get people to behave in a certain way, reduce the friction as much as possible, right? So like, if you want to make sure that you run every day in the morning, set out your clothes before you go to bed so that you can get out, put your clothes on and run right away. And so, I mean, I actually do think that there is some usefulness here, both a nudge, in the nudge and the frictionless process that is relevant. So, you know, as we're coming to a close today, and it's been really, I mean, as always, it's been really great having this conversation with you and talking about these issues. And I appreciate everyone who've been here and providing sort of their own thoughts and fielding questions. It's been really useful. So much of the conversation today has been on, you've mentioned bad citizens a few times, but mostly it's been focusing on, good citizens. And in fact, you know, our research, which thus far has produced three articles have been published, a fourth on the way, that have all focused on trying to explain the good citizen. And so it was only in the last couple months that you and I started thinking there might be something to try to unpack what the bad citizen is. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, again, very early stages, but maybe tell our participants a bit about what we've been thinking in terms of a bad, explaining and understanding bad citizens in China?
So it goes back to this sort of altruistic act. You know, it goes back to this idea, whether or not in the Chinese context is moral altruism understood differently? So perhaps, you know, this sort of moral altruistic acts is defined or perhaps influenced by their most immediate social circle. And it makes sense. Like when we look at our data, people volunteer, they donate because, you know, they know others or they're influenced by others. So perhaps and some of the things we've been having these conversations about is, well, moral altruism may not be fixed if it's influenced by their immediate social circle. And so if your social circle changes over time, maybe your moral altruism levels might shift. So we need to pay homage to that idea. As I suggested, you know, in our surveys, we saw participants were influenced to engage in volunteerism or charity giving due to their peers or family friends. And so what are the implications of this? Does this mean that volunteerism and charitable giving may not be stable in the long term? This is something we need to think about a bit more deeply. What if it's based on some level of altruism, it's based some level on someone's social groups. That's why you volunteer or you give. Is this learning short term or is there long term learning to this? And I think that's something we need to really delve deeper into in the works that we're going to be doing this year and next year, I guess, well, mostly next year. So that's sort of our idea. I mean, there's an altruistic versus self-interestedness sort of variations about what the bad citizen is.
Yeah.
There's instrumental reasons we can measure as well. When the social credit system, we can actually see what the state sees as what's a good citizen and what's bad. A bad would be someone who has negative points. A good would be someone who gets positive points. That's a really instrumental way to look at it. But there's also a philosophical conversation to be had. And I think that's both elements we might be exploring.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear too, you know, we somewhat are flippantly saying bad citizen, good citizen. because what we actually, in neither paper are we making normative judgments about this behavior. Mm-hmm. We're drawing on just kind of assumptions. And in this exploration and in this next paper that we're going to be writing, we're really interested in people who don't volunteer and mm-hmm. don't give philanthropically, and trying to understand that. And as you already suggested, what our data seems to show quite clearly, that people who aren't giving and aren't volunteering, A, don't have people around them that are doing it. So there mm-hmm. is a real social aspect to it. Mm-hmm. But B, you know, they don't view voluntaristic activity and philanthropic giving as a demonstrable good. Mm-hmm. So it's unfair to say that it's not a matter of them not being altruistic. It's that they don't believe that behavior is altruistic behavior. Mm-hmm. Essentially, mm-hmm. we are unable, based upon our data, and frankly, I think it's really difficult for anybody to say with certainty, is someone altruistic or is someone not altruistic? But what we can say is that, you know, people who aren't doing this don't see that activity as a very good thing. They actually mm-hmm. see the activity as self-interested. So, you know, essentially the argument that we seem to be developing is that people who aren't giving and aren't volunteering their time might actually be very altruistic people. They just don't think mm-hmm. that that's altruistic behavior. Mm-hmm. We can't say what they are, but we can say what they see.
So there's two things to add, I guess, as a sort of concluding bit to that statement there. One, I think when you look at the younger cohorts, they are primed to donate, they're primed to volunteer. And so in many respects, if they're not volunteering yet, if they're not donating yet, they're primed because the citizenship sort of education that they're getting is priming them to do that in the future. Second, we might have to, you know, be flexible in our definitions of what's altruistic and what's self-interestedness. So there's both a definitional issue, but also something to look forward to in our future waves is those who did not volunteer in the past, why are they volunteering now? And I would suggest to you that with greater education, greater exposure, that's going to lead to greater levels of volunteerism. Finally, and perhaps a third point, which I didn't mention, is, well, there's also instrumental reasons. Maybe the tax code might change. Most people give because around this time is the best time to give in many Western jurisdictions because that's the end of the tax year. Britain might be April, you know, it's different tax years. At the end of the tax year, you generally give. So there's an instrumental reason. You volunteer because in Canada, for many of our provinces, you volunteered in order to get your high school diploma. You need to get 100 hours of volunteerism, for example. So there are instrumental reasons that might be employed in China that might encourage people to volunteer. Now, can we divorce the altruism from those instrumental reasons? That's a difficult bit. And that's something that you've highlighted. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I just put a couple links both to my personal website and your personal website. You know, for those who've joined us today, just wanted to kind of remind everybody that the work that we're talking about has already been published, you know, various aspects of it in several different articles. There's an article in the Journal of Current Chinese Affairs on how Chinese citizens sort of see civil society organizations, especially in times of crisis and COVID. We had some very interesting data that was collected right before COVID and right after COVID was announced. So you could look at that. We also have a piece on citizen-led volunteers and the role that that can play in democratic learning, and that's in the journal Democratization. And then we have another article in the Journal of Contemporary China on Chinese education and the role that plays in voluntaristic activity. But stay tuned. You know, there's going to be more of this research that we're producing. And again, it's a longitudinal study. And that's great because hopefully we'll begin to see either shifts or non-shifts. Even non-shifts are interesting, to what extent are these attitudes kind of baked in, or are they going to be fluctuating over time? You know, might they be sensitive to either changing politics in China, changing policy in China, and obviously the presence of, exogenous shocks like COVID. So I wanted to thank Riza again for joining today. It was really a pleasure, as always. And just a reminder to participants that there will be another seminar in our monthly seminar series on China and the World that will be held in person at LSE on the 9th of January. That will also include free food. Free food! Don't say that there's no such thing as a free lunch, because there is a free lunch on January 19th at the LSE Fudan China and the World Seminar Series. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. It was a pleasure. Take good care.
Thank you, everyone.